to deny safe havens to terrorists. That may be one of the big messages he might be bringing.
The top U.S. diplomat stops in Afghanistan to discuss the new U.S. South Asia strategy. It's Tuesday, October 24th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Shinzo Abe and his party retains power in Japan, helping Pakistan's acid attack victims. U.S.-Singapore relations remain strong, controlling anger and self-driving boats. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made an unannounced visit to Afghanistan Monday to discuss the new U.S. strategy for South Asia with the country's leaders. Tillerson met Monday with Afghan officials, including President Ashraf Ghani. The talks were held at Bagram Air Base outside of Kabul. VOA's Sarah Williams spoke with VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim, who's in the Afghan capital, about Tillerson's visit.
Well, what we know is that Secretary Tillerson was here to discuss the new U.S. strategy for South Asia that was announced by President Trump a little while ago. Secretary Tillerson's first visit to Kabul involved his meeting with not just President Ashraf Ghani, but also with CEO Abdullah Abdullah and Afghan National Security Advisor Hanif Atmar. And what we know from the statement issued by the U.S. Embassy in Kabul is that the secretary told the Afghan government that America is committed not just to work with Afghanistan, but also to work with other countries in the region to make sure that there's peace and security in Afghanistan, and also to make sure that the terrorists who are standing in the way of that goal are denied safe havens. Now, when you're talking about safe havens and terrorism in this region, we have to remember that both Afghanistan and the U.S. have long alleged that neighboring Pakistan is providing safe havens to particularly the Haqqani network in the Afghan Taliban. Now, the Pakistani government always denies those charges and claims that it has cleared out whatever safe havens were on its territory through a military operation over the last 2 years. But recently, we saw this charge emerge again more strongly. We saw last week a couple, an American woman with her Canadian husband, were rescued in the region from the Pakistani side of the border after a tip by the U.S. intelligence. We saw CIA Director Mike Pompeo give a statement saying to a Washington think tank saying the couple had been kept in Pakistan for all of the 5 years of its captivity. Those statements kind of contradict what came from Pakistani officials, which was that the couple was moved from Afghanistan to Pakistan very recently. So Secretary Tillerson was here. He's expected to have left the city under very strict security. We didn't know he was here, but we could suspect something was going on. There were a large number of helicopters in the air. But you know that when, you know, Defense Secretary James Mattis came to Afghanistan last month, there was an attack on Kabul airport. So obviously, and during the last 1 week, there have been several attacks in Kabul itself. So security was probably high on the minds of all U.S. officials and, you know, people who were trying to protect Secretary Tillerson, which is why the visit was kept so confidential that I don't even think the State Department press corps knew the exact date and time of when he was going to travel here.
Well, now, Secretary Tillerson, I believe, is staying in, he's left Afghanistan, but is staying in South Asia. Is he going on, will he be stopping in Pakistan?
Yes, I think from Afghanistan, he will go to Pakistan tomorrow and then on to India either tomorrow evening or early Wednesday morning. I don't think he'll spend the night in Pakistan, again, due to security concerns. So he will probably move on to India tomorrow evening. In Pakistan, there have been reports from Washington indicating that he's coming with a tough message. And if we see this rhetoric of safe havens, and today the statement coming out of the U.S. Embassy saying that the secretary has clarified that U.S. wants to work with partners in the region to deny safe havens to terrorists, that may be one of the big messages he might be bringing to Pakistan. Now, on the Pakistani side, one of their top priorities, one of the messages that they might want to give to U.S. is that they're very uncomfortable with the alleged, with the stated element of the new U.S. policy, which is an enhanced role for India in Afghanistan. Pakistan has always been uncomfortable with Indian presence in Afghanistan. The two countries, India and Pakistan, have always had a roller coaster relationship in their 70-year history of independence from the British. And right now, it seems to be the time when the roller coaster is going downward.
VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim in Kabul. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. White House says Trump Asia trip aims to keep world from plunging into darker era. Japan says North Korea nuclear threat critical. Philippines declares siege by Islamic rebels over in Marawi City. Taiwan steps up Asia business to reduce dependence on China. United Nations Pledging Conference seeks $434 million for Rohingya refugee aid. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, we invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party, along with its coalition partner Komito, captured 312 of the parliament's 465 lower house seats in Sunday's snap election. That assures Prime Minister Shinzo Abe a supermajority and improves his prospects of becoming the country's longest-serving prime minister in post-war Japan. Mr. Abe said the election was firstly about the North Korea threat, vowing to pursue strong, resolute diplomacy, and also about Japan's declining birth rate, an issue he described as a national crisis. Jeff Kingston, Asian Studies professor at Tokyo's Temple University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, absent any strong opposition, there was little doubt the LDP ruling bloc would prevail.
The ruling coalition is still extremely strong, dominant in the Diet, but they did actually lose seats. And the big benefit to the ruling coalition was that they were running against a divided opposition. And when the ruling party is running against more than one other candidate, the opposition divides the anti-LDP vote, and the LDP romps to victory. So this is pretty anticlimactic. Every single poll was projecting a big LDP victory, and at the end of the day, they came through. So I guess Abe will feel vindicated in calling the snap elections early, despite the fact that about 70% of the people didn't think they were necessary.
Assuming that he retains his post as party leader of the LDP, Mr. Abe is set to become the longest-serving prime minister in quite some time.
Yes, he looks like in good shape to win the party leadership elections next September, and that would extend his leadership to 2021. But a lot can happen between now and then. This summer, Abe was down at 26% support in the polls. He had sunk from 60% earlier in the year, and this was due to a couple of scandals and a cover-up involving his defense minister. So the two cronyism scandals haven't gone away, and so after the election dust settles, he's still going to be facing questions because 80% of the public don't believe his denials.
A lot of the news coverage centers on his re-energizing push to revise the country's pacifist post-war constitution. Is that the key issue that's facing voters now?
Well, I think that certainly it was one of the big issues. Normally, elections are fought over the state of the economy and Social Security, pensions, things like that. But clearly, anxiety about the North Korean missile test, I think, created a move to rally around the flag that benefited the LDP. But the constitutional revision issue is one in which the opposition focused and said, you know, this is trampling on Japan's post-war norms and values. And an upstart party led by Yukio Edano, called the Constitutional Democratic Party, more than trebled their seats from 15 to like about 54. And after there's some horse trading post-election, they're likely to have the largest opposition force in the Diet. They'll probably be over 70 seats. But they just did a survey in the news this morning on NHK that found that out of the 465 members of the Diet, 371 favor some form of constitutional revision. So one has to say this election put wind in his sails, but figuring out what to revise and how to revise it could prove divisive.
Jeff Kingston said even if the constitutional amendment passes both houses of parliament, it faces an uncertain future in a public referendum where simple majority is required for any change. Happening now in Asia, the United Nations holds a conference to generate funds for the nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees now residing in Bangladesh after fleeing violence in Myanmar. The special one-day pledging conference is to raise $434 million to provide life-saving assistance. The refugee count during the past 2 months now topping 600,000. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you for listening. Acid attacks are an all-too-common problem in Pakistan, as in many other countries in South and East Asia. Almost all Pakistani victims are women. VOA's Salman Khan recently visited a center that not only helps victims recover physically from their injuries, it helps them rebuild their lives.
My husband did this. After I was divorced, I was taking my kids to school. He came from behind and threw acid on me.
Victims often are left so scarred that society rejects them, adding to their pain.
I was in such a bad shape. I was even scared of myself. When I looked into the mirror, I was terrified. Some people even started joking about it. When I would go somewhere, people would say, "She must have been at fault. She must have done something wrong."
Here at the Smile Foundation, attack victims rebuild their lives.
All my surgeries have been done through Ms. Musarat. I have gone through 6 surgeries so far.
The Smile Foundation has helped nearly 800 victims since opening in 2003. Chairwoman Musarat Misbah says some were as young as 3.
On average, a girl has to go through 35 to 40 surgeries before she can begin to look a little better, but they never get their old face back.
After the surgeries are done, the foundation helps the women learn skills so they can earn a living. Another group, the Aurat Foundation, is working to stop acid attacks. It wants to get laws restricting acid sales fully enforced.
The law on acid throwing stipulated that acid sellers would be required to get a license. They have to get that license renewed, but this has never been implemented. It's necessary that the acid bottles priced at 10 to 15 rupees be banned.
Victims also say that the punishment for acid attacks is too lenient.
Those who commit this crime get 14 years in prison. However, they get out after 7 years and live the life they wanted. However, we remain here. We want them to also go through the same ordeal as us, so they can realize how the situation is faced.
For Salman Khan of VOA's Urdu service in Lahore, I am Sahar Majid, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Philippine troops are celebrating the end of a 5-month battle against Islamic State supporters in Marawi that claimed more than 1,000 lives. The siege has raised wider concerns that Islamic State loyalists have ambitions to make Muslim areas of the island of Mindanao a base for operations in Southeast Asia. Visit VOA 60 for more on this and other news in Asia, and visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, President Trump hosted Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong at the White House Monday. That included the two leaders watching the signing of a new Boeing deal with Singapore International Airlines that will create 70,000 jobs in the United States.
Earlier today, the Prime Minister and I witnessed a contract signing between Singapore Airlines, a great airline, and Boeing worth more than $13.8 billion. I want to thank the Singaporean people for their faith in the American engineering and the American workers, and our American workers deliver the best product.
The previously announced Boeing deal highlighted an Oval Office meeting and a private working luncheon. Trump, who will embark on a 12-day trip to Asia next month, added that the relationship between the United States and Singapore is at its highest point and will continue.
Both the United States and Singapore understand the unmatched power of private enterprise to uplift the human condition. These values have made our society stronger, sustained our partnership through the Cold War, and laid a critical foundation for our lasting relationship today. Our common values and interests have led to a vital security relationship. Throughout Southeast Asia, the United States and Singapore are currently working to enhance the capacity of law enforcement, fight terrorism, and bolster cyber defenses. Our two nations also share an unwavering commitment to countering the North Korean threat and promoting freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. Singapore was the first Southeast Asian nation to join the coalition to defeat ISIS. That was very far-thinking. You were there before most. More than 1,000 of its military personnel train here in the United States every single year.
Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong urged a good dialogue with China when President Trump makes his first visit there.
President Trump will be visiting China in a few weeks' time as part of his first visit to Asia. Singapore, like many other countries, watch your relations with China very closely. It's the most important bilateral relationship in the world. China is the U.S.'s third largest export market for both goods and services. For agricultural exports, it's the second largest. They buy soybeans, grains, and cotton, as well as farming machinery. And I'm quite sure that as their incomes go up, they'll buy more and more good American beef. I express my hope that the U.S. will be able to maintain a stable and constructive relationship with China. Engaging each other at the highest levels, building trust, establishing institutional mechanisms. Good U.S.-China relations will benefit the region and the world. They will enable countries in the Asia-Pacific, including America and China themselves, to enjoy regional stability, peace, and prosperity.
Although a stop in Singapore is not on President Trump's Asia trip, the Prime Minister extended an invitation for a future visit, which Mr. Trump accepted. This news alert from VOA Asia, China has lifted its ban on moldy cheeses after meetings with the European Commission permitting imports of soft cheeses such as Brie and Roquefort. The authorities imposed the ban in September because the strains of bacteria used to make the cheeses were not approved in China. You're approved to visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia in Greek, pneuma means breath and spirit, and that's the core philosophy of a relatively new program in Baltimore, Maryland, with the same name. Pneuma combines exercise, yoga, and leadership training, and behind this program is a near-death experience that made a young man bitter and angry. That led him to become forgiving and proactive. As Faiza El Masri reports and Faith Lapidus narrates, Damian Cooper founded the Project Pneuma to teach boys how to control their anger and inspire them to achieve their dreams in life.
One, two, three, four.
Twice a week, all year long, a group of about two dozen boys gathers at Baltimore Police Academy to participate in Pneuma.
What is your vision?
To strive and teach our young men the art of forgiveness, self-control, and discipline.
They joined the program because they had difficulty focusing in school or controlling their impulses. Here, they exercise and meet with adults who care about them, like school principal Nicomar Mosley, who volunteers with the program.
We allow our students to engage in the different push-ups and the sit-ups and things that will build them physically, sometimes with the physical push that helps to keep their minds focused.
Pneuma founder Damian Cooper says other exercises focus on breathing.
We want our young men to understand that oftentimes they're acting off of impulse actions. And they don't think about what they're doing, they just act. So what we try to do is get them to slow down. If you take a deep breath, it slows things down.
And that makes it easier for them to control their anger and learn to forgive. Cooper says it took him more than 4 years to learn this lesson. 24 years ago, he was shot, and the bullet stopped within an inch of his heart. He became very bitter and angry until he decided he had to move on.
I started doing some volunteer work in a prison, and unbeknown to me, for a year and a half, I wound up mentoring the very young man who shot me. And once we found out that this was a young man, I forgave him.
Finding the strength to forgive is one of the lessons Project Numa kids learn. Cooper's 14-year-old son Nigel says joining the program is a transforming experience.
My best friends have gone through this program, and they used to always fight no matter what somebody would say to them. But now they calm down to the point where you could push them and they could look at you and just be like, shrug their shoulders.
The participants range in age from 9 to 14.
As we look at the older students, they work together to help the younger students. It gives the younger children an opportunity to look up to someone and to develop a big brother within the program. So it develops leadership amongst our children, and it also helps keep it diverse. So the program is ever evolving. As those children that are currently participating, they grow up, they get older, and they become the mentors for the younger participants.
Numa is also engaging these boys, young and old, in serious discussions about themselves and their community.
But the fact is, some of you guys want to be mathematicians, engineers, singing. And you know what? You've seen the work of animals, right?
The Numa founder says the results so far suggest that the program is working well.
Since we started Project Numa, none of the young men have been suspended at all, not one. Because the parents allow us to come to the school and to check on their sons. We check report cards, we check grades, we pop up, and we make sure that they stay on task.
14-year-old Virtue Bama says he's always excited about attending NUMA sessions.
This program is very invigorating. This program is very fun for me to be around.
Not only is it invigorating and fun, but kids have stayed with the NUMA project for more than 3 years now, because it offers something many of them are missing in their lives: encouragement, moral support, and consistency. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
While car manufacturers are racing to get self-driving cars on the road, researchers are well ahead in developing self-driving vessels on the water that could soon start ferrying passengers and cargo in busy ports. VOA's George Pudich has more.
If you happen to visit Boston Harbor and see a boat clearly marked unmanned vessel, don't be fooled by the presence of a human on board. The boat is still being driven by artificial intelligence.
I am here to make sure that we avoid any possible collisions that might happen that were not caught by the autonomy system.
Much like self-driving cars, in this phase of maritime testing, a human overseer is still required. But researchers say in the near future, the only people on such boats would be passengers and cargo handlers.
The oceanic environment is the perfect domain for autonomy. You know, it has the wide open operating spaces. It has relatively slower speeds when compared to cars, and not a lot of civilian life that could possibly run out in front of you as well.
Researchers say all the needed technology is already here, and the onboard radars, sensors, and computers can easily avoid obstacles. As a precaution, a human operator based on shore can remotely monitor several boats and take over in case of emergency.
What we want to do is create a technology that makes it safer than what we're doing right now. And as soon as it is safer and cheaper, I think you're going to see that happening.
Self-driving ocean-going ships may be operational in the next decade, but for smaller work boats like these, the technology is already available. George Pudich, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We'd like to say hello to everyone who's listening in Myanmar via Facebook on VOA Burmese. Thanks for joining us today. We also invite you to write us. Also on Facebook, you can do that on VOA Asia's page if you like, or you can send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. We're not fully autonomous by any means. We have a director. It's Tracy Carter. Our engineer, Daryl Smith. Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, David Bird, Skylar Ogden on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.